Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm going to be reading articles that were published by the Geographic Society in April of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article titled, A Guide to Bad Ischl, the Alps' first European capital of culture. Sitting between Baroque Salzburg and Austria's Alps, Bad Ischl, the 2024 European capital of culture, combines the appeal of both, by Ellen Himmelfarb. Every summer day at 6 a.m., 19th century Empress Sisi left her holiday hunting lodge in the Austrian resort of Bad Ischl to hike up Jainzen, the forested mountain looming just behind. The average ascent is about an hour, but they say it took the tall, tattooed wife of Austro-Hungarian Emperor Franz Joseph I just 40 minutes to reach the peak. With the spare time, she might ride one of her 50 horses, exercise on wooden machines she designed for her home gym, scoff violent pastries, or smoke in her lavish gardens. Over a century since Sisi's death, this town east of Salzburg remains a summer playground among wellness enthusiasts and anyone with two poles to hike with. It's a gateway to the alpine lakes and mountains of Salzkammergut, a region whose name translates to salt domain, a nod to a local salt mining tradition that dates back 7,000 years. It's partly thanks to this history and pastoral charm that the entire region was anointed one of three 2024 European capitals of culture, with Bad Ischl the banner town, the first rural alpine destination to wear the mantle. In the center, Zauner Café serves glossy iced gâteau. Steps from the villa where the 19th century composer Anton Bruckner penned his symphonies. A 15th century church steeple still presides over the cobbled square, lined with lederhosen shops. However, this year a defunct brewery is coming back to life as a gallery for Japanese artist Motoya Yamamoto, who creates mosaics in salt, and contemporary weavers are reinvigorating a textile mill in Ebensee, 20 miles away by car, spinning old tales into new art. Some of the 150 or so projects in the calendar are likely to become permanent, like the takeover of the former restaurant at Bad Ischl station by star chef Christoph Crowley Held. The other forgotten attraction to be revived for the festivities is the vintage cog Schaffberg Railway. At just over 3.5 miles in length, the line from St. Wolfgang, another village in the region, heads around 4,000 feet of Schaffberg Mountain. From its peak, the landscape unfurls to the hazy horizon. Bad Ischl to the east, the white-capped Alps to the south, and all around the region's 76 glacial lakes, pure and sapphire blue. Austrians head to these lakes to experience clean living and white tablecloth dining from another era. In St. Wolfgang, where some women still wear drindles, where grocery shopping, the tabletop is lakeside at Landhaus zu Oppensbach, opt for the venison, served with brioche dumplings and Burgundermacher Pinot. Walk the meal off around the village, where a 12th century church attracts Catholics. A different sort of pilgrim will head for the shore to swim by moonlight, perhaps rewarding themselves with small batch gin from a 24-hour vending machine next to C. Dillastree. Visitors are often surprised by modern anachronisms like the gin machine. Another one can be found in tiny Fuchsia-Lassie, the next lake over, where the rambling 600-year-old Slosh Fuchsial Castle has been nipped and tucked into a suave rosewood hotel, opening in May. Locals cram into the next-door fishery for plates of wood-smoked char, supplied by the lake's sole licensed fishermen. Those in the know hit the shop before the 6 p.m. closing to stock up for a sunset picnic. Others hop on wooden water taxis for the slow, silent drift to Fuchsial Town and scramble up mountains such as Elmostine or steeper Schober to watch the view reinvent itself in golds and pinks. A 20-minute drive away is the new Combe Spitz Observation Tower, high above Mondsee. A drive around this lake distills the region to its essential ingredients, gingerbread cottages, pilgrimage chapels, misty waterfalls, and a warm swimming cove to bathe in. If it's not sufficiently cultural, Bad Ischl is always less than an hour's drive away, though Cece would have walked it, of course. And that completes the first article, A Guide to Bad Ischl, The Alps' First European Capital of Culture, by Ellen Himmelfarb. The next article is Beauty is Pain, at least it was in 17th century Spain. Pale skin, red cheeks, and blonde hair were beauty necessities for Spanish women in the 1600s, but the effect of these cosmetics came with a poisonous price, some even causing blindness, by Barbara Rossillo. Writing her travels into Spain in 1679, French author Marie-Catherine Le Jumel de Barneville, known as Madame de Aulnoy, recorded her less than flattering impressions of the complexions of Spanish women. I have never seen boiled crayfish of a more beautiful color. The effect of redness that startled Madame de Aulnoy was produced by rouge, or blush, applied in staggering quantities. Elsewhere, Madame de Aulnoy recounts how a Spanish lady took a cup full of rouge and a big paintbrush. She put it on not only her cheeks, her chin, under her nose, under her eyebrows, and around her ears, but she also bedabbed the inside of her hands, her fingers, and her shoulders. Madame de Aulnoy was looking back on her experiences of living in Spain in the 1670s, the final years of what historians traditionally call Spain's Edad de Oro, or Golden Age. Beginning with Spain's rise as a European superpower and its colonization of swaths of Central and South America from 1492, the Golden Age waned as Spain's economic problems worsened in the late 1600s. While it lasted, many aspects of Spanish culture, including literature and theater, were lavishly celebrated. Travelers' accounts note how the country's great wealth and power were reflected in women's appearances. Richard Wynne, a politician who accompanied Prince Charles I of England on a trip to Spain in 1623, wrote that, "Of all these women, I dare take my oath, there was not one unpainted, so visibly that you would think they would rather wore vizards' masks than their own faces." Extreme makeovers. According to cultural historian Amanda Wunder, author of the book Spanish Fashion in the Age of Velázquez, in terms of fashion and beauty, Spain was going in a different direction than the rest of the European continent. Whereas the French and English leaned toward natural complexions, Spanish beauty was all about being the fanciest and most elaborately made up, she explained. The Spanish court set the standard for the rest of society. By then, the wealthy were much more visible in public than they had been in the Middle Ages. Nobility and royalty appeared regularly at the theater or hung their likenesses in portraits in public spaces during festivals. The ideas of beauty they projected spread down through the different levels of society. Everyone was putting on layers of makeup, from the queen downward. This was a cross-class phenomenon, explained Wunder. To achieve the sought-after experience in Spain's golden age, ladies would put themselves through a long and complex grooming process. They even had a special room set aside for the purpose, a kind of boudoir, known in Spanish as a tocador. The term was originally used to designate the cap that men and women wore to bed, but it later came to refer to the room itself. The tocador was where ladies would dress and take care of their hair and makeup. It was here that ladies kept their skin and hair treatments, makeup, and beauty paraphernalia. The box used to store this beauty kit was also called a tocador. Some of these boxes were beautifully crafted. Inside, cosmetics were kept in pots and bottles, and in the center was a small mirror. Depending on a lady's wealth, the mirrors might come in lavish frames of Indian ebony, stained wood, or even silver. Beyond the pale. In 17th century Spain and beyond, the ideal of feminine beauty was blonde hair and a deathly pallor. In Spain, it was a relatively common practice for women to bleach their faces. Solimen, a cosmetic made from mercury preparations, was used for this purpose. Its chemical composition could do lasting damage to the skin. Meanwhile, bleaches, diluted to varying strengths, were used to lighten hair. As Madame d'Aulnoy had so memorably observed, the staple in the Spanish tocador at that time was rouge, known in Spanish as color de granada, or pomegranate color. It was sold wrapped in sheets of paper that were kept in small cups, called salserias. Having made their faces very pale, women then painted their lips and cheeks with this rouge and darkened their eyebrows with a mix of alcohol and black minerals. To keep their hands white and soft, they would apply a paste made from almonds, mustard, and honey. Among other chemicals used in products, sulfur was perhaps the most widespread. Some of these components were harmful. Women occasionally whitened their faces with bismuth oxychloride, sometimes known as Spanish white, a skin and eye irritant. Or they used lead precipitates, which are toxic. The composition of rouge has changed over the centuries, but in Spain's golden age, it was often made from charred sulfur, mercury, lead, minium, a lead compound, and other substances. These preparations could cause headaches, permanently alter the skin, and damage eyesight because of their toxicity, dangerous effects that were noted at the time. Commentators saw other toxic effects in beauty products. To the mainly male writers of the period, makeup was tantamount to deceit. A literary trope of the time was to reproach a woman who artificially embellished herself. When the time came for her to be seen without adornments, her lover would be disappointed. Brazen face. The moralist Juan de Japaleta, in his book El Día de Fiesta, Por la Mañana, Por la Tarde, published in 1654, attacked the use of cosmetics on religious grounds. He set the action in the tocador of a lady getting ready on the morning of a holiday. she places on her right hand the box of beauty medicines and begins to improve her face with them. This woman does not consider that, if God wanted her to be as she paints herself, he would have painted her first. God gave her the face that suited her, and she takes on the face that does not suit her. Zabaleta's work is part of a history of misogynist literature that condemns women's beauty rituals as tampering with God's creation. Some women agreed that such rituals were fatuous, but for very different reasons. Maria de Zayas, a Golden Age Spanish writer, today considered a proto-feminist, viewed the social pressures on women to apply makeup as a means to prevent them from emancipating themselves. In a novel from the 1630s, she has one of her characters say that if women applied themselves to training with weapons and studying the sciences, instead of growing their hair and shading their faces, they could already have surpassed men in many things. The Spanish Infanta, or the eldest princess, of King Philip IV, Maria Theresa, is depicted here in Diego Velázquez's 1651-54 portrait. She is in her early teens. The viewer's gaze is arrested both by her elaborate headdress adorned with butterflies and the heavy amounts of rouge applied to her whitened face. Participating in the royal delegation to Spain in 1623, English courtier Richard Wynne commented on very young women at the Spanish court being made up. They were painted more than the ordinary women, though some of them were not 13 years old. The purpose of Velázquez's famous portrait was to attract a future husband. In 1660, at age 22, Maria Theresa married Louis XIV of France. As Spain's imperial fortunes waned in the late 1600s and the Golden Age ended, the heavy use of makeup in Spain also diminished. With the French Revolution in 1789, a more natural look swept through Europe, and elaborate wigs and makeup were shunned. Attitudes toward makeup, however, are often cyclical. Safer zinc oxide-based powders later replaced toxic lead-based recipes, and makeup's usage rebounded in Europe. Then, in the mid-1800s, heavy makeup fell out of fashion, associated with actresses and prostitutes. Facial artifice came back to the forefront with the advent of theatrical cosmetics and became widely commercialized in Europe and North America in the 1920s. Since then, its use in the context of femininity and feminism has been as heatedly discussed as it was in the Golden Age of Spain. That ends the article. The title was Beauty is Pain, at least it was in 17th century Spain, by Barbara Rocio. The next title is Why Midlife Looks Different for Millennials. This generation isn't meeting their parents' benchmarks for adulthood, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, by Alyssa Greenberg. If you want to get a sense of how American midlife has changed, look no further than 1991 comedy Father of the Bride, in which actors Steve Martin and Diane Keaton play parents in their mid-40s. Conversation around a 2022 viral tweet calling out those portrayals largely agrees. Whatever the movie's ideal of middle age, it doesn't resemble today's spry 40-year-olds. Yet midlife looks different now, in fashion, in youthful attitude, and in cold, hard numbers. Most days, with no kids, no husband, no mortgage, I don't think of myself as a real grown-up at 37, at least not of the Keaton-Martin caliber. Sure, some people of my generation will soon have kids old enough to get married, but many are just having their first children. The median age of mothers giving birth increased to 30 between 1990 and 2019. Or, like one-fifth of adults, don't plan to have kids at all. As millennials hit middle age, difficult financial and cultural realities leave many of us with a similar sense that we're not living up to the standards of modern adulthood. But changing ideas about aging are also shaping our midlife behavior in new ways, creating more space for accomplishments and adventure. Financial strain means delays for starting a family and home ownership. Rewriting the rules of development is nothing new for millennials. Even in the early 2000s, social scientists noticed that the eldest millennials, those born starting around 1981, although the exact cutoff year is still under debate, weren't hitting the typical markers of finishing education, getting jobs, getting married, and having kids, says Karen Fingerman, a professor of human development at UT Austin and director of the Texas Aging and Longevity Consortium. 24 years later, we're continuing to delay both marriage and childbearing, says Carolina Arageo, who studies social and demographic trends at the Pew Research Center. Her research shows that the percentage of today's adults aged 30 to 34 who are married is down more than 10% over the last two decades. The mean age of first motherhood in 2021 was also 27.3, the highest it's ever been. And another recent Pew poll found 44% of non-parent adults aged 18 to 49 plan to stay that way. Financial pressures are affecting the timing of these milestones. A 2024 report from the National Association of Realtors found that a third of older millennials owe over $40,000 in student loans, and that we delay buying homes primarily because of both that debt and high rental costs, which prevents us from saving for a down payment. Between mortgages, health care, elder care, and child care, midlife has always been expensive, but for millennials it is proving especially crushing. According to an article by researchers at the Center for Household Financial Stability, median millennials' swing savings in 2016 was $23,200, 34% lower than expected income based on historic trends. The theory of a universal midlife crisis phenomenon has long been debunked, says Margie Lockman, a professor of psychology at Brandeis University, who focuses on midlife. In reality, only a small percentage of people report experiencing one, and the crisis can happen at many different ages. Instead, midlife has historically been a time to shift focus from oneself to other people, to find meaning through mentoring or getting involved in activism. A shift in focus also means juggling priorities and increased stress, says Lackman. During this period, a person is likely to have the broadest constellation of roles: parent, spouse, or partner, sibling, co-worker, or boss, community leader, friend, and sometimes even grandparent, she says. People are really depending on you, pulling perhaps in different directions. But the dual trends of millennials having children later and parents living longer intensifies this sandwich generation phenomenon. While the sense of control over one's life generally peaks at midlife, Lackman says, more recently born generations progressively feel less in control than previous generations. But with a lack of structure also comes a burgeoning flexibility, and some millennials feel excited about the idea of staying young longer. Biotech advancements helped increase the fertility rate of mothers aged 40 to 45 by 132% between 1990 and 2019, giving women more time before motherhood than ever. Recent national health trends data shows late-life independence is on the rise, with fewer adults over age 72 reporting unmet self-care and mobility needs, and a 10% jump in people with high physical capacity in that age group, reaching almost one-third between 2011 and 2019. The result is a broad canvas millennials are filling in a multitude of new ways. One of these ways is travel. Radha Vyas, CEO and co-founder of the midlife group travel company Flashpack, sees the popularity of her business as stemming in part from millennials using scrimped and saved money toward new priorities. Flashpackers are often unmarried and child-free. Many are traveling after a layoff. In losing traditional structures of adulthood, millennials have also gained new freedom, Fingerman says, making a space for a version of adulthood where you don't have to leave the parent home to be an adult. You don't have to get married to be an adult. Take, for example, the surge in popularity of co-living, developing trends in non-monogamy, or the rise of digital nomadism. If your identity is less constrained by the need to accomplish a specific societal goal, then you're freer to derive meaning from other experiences, she said. And with that, we've run out of time today. The title of this article was Why Midlife Looks Different for Millennials by Alyssa Greenberg. This has been the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading articles published in April 2024 by the Geographic Society. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on Demand. Here you'll see a list of the articles that are available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.